Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll listen to stories recorded at Fringe, True Stories from Outsiders, an Iowa Watch storytelling event. These stories were recorded live on Thursday, March 29th. We'll hear from five different storytellers today. And first, John Paul Derryberry. By day, he's executive director of Family Promise of Linn County, an alternative solution homeless shelter in Cedar Rapids. He's also a public speaker on a mission to chase the invisible.
So I want to talk about the elephant in the room. I'm not an outsider. I am a Caucasian, heterosexual, 35-year-old male. The world has been set up for me to be successful. I am the definition of insider. But who I am is someone who has spent the last 15 years helping outsiders find their place. And it's been amazing. And whether that was at the abused teen home, when I worked with the young man who was struggling with schizophrenia because his dad locked him in the basement when he went to go cook meth, whether that was when I was working with a man who had autism and was nonverbal and recently discovered his erections. And if you ever want to have the toughest job in the world, explain to someone who is nonverbal what an erection is. Or whether it was I was working with the single mother who left her abusive relationship because she told me, everyone tells you that's what you do when you're in an abusive relationship, you leave, you be strong. But she ended up in a homeless shelter. And then she looked at me and she goes, now I get judged for being a bad mom because I'm homeless. These are the outsiders that I've spent my life with. And I have thousands of stories about each and every one of them. But tonight's story starts with a 2-inch thick file that landed on my desk with a thud. And it was about a young man who had been kicked out of 10 residential treatment centers across Iowa and every foster care placement he's ever been in because he was violent. He bit, he hit, he kicked, he threw poop, and he peed on people. And as I read through his file, I learned that he had been locked in his cabinet by his biological parents for sometimes up to 8 to 10 hours a day. He's the definition of fringe outsider. Society has told him he does not belong. And when you read a file about someone who's that violent, you picture in your head 6'4", 275 pounds. Everyone's scared of him. And so the first day in his program, I'm standing here waiting for him to come to our program. And all the staff are nervous. Everyone's nervous when you get a file like that. And he turns the corner, and he's 5'0", 100 pounds, carrying an old man's suitcase and a fedora hat on, and walks in the door and goes, hi, guys. And I immediately think, like, this is the toughest case in Iowa? This is the kid that no one will help? 3 days later, I learned why. He was playing with his toys. He had really cool toys. I was jealous. And we asked him to clean up, but he was actually playing with the other kids in the program as a young teenager. And when we asked him, we told him it was time to clean up, he threw a fit, called everyone a bunch of names, and threw his toys at everybody and everyone. I asked him why later, and he goes, well, it was the first time anyone ever played with me. And my heart melted for this young man for two reasons. One, I love anyone who tells off an authority figure. They're my favorite. Two, he wasn't afraid to play with his toys at 14. I'm super jealous of that. I'm afraid to play with my toys, and I'm 35. He was willing to be himself. He was cool. He just didn't know it. And so we kept trying to work with him and get him to realize that. And so it was time to make his goals. And so I go to him, and I go, all right, we need to go down to the office to make your goals. And he goes, this is bullshit. You go, why? He goes, every program I'm in, they make me make my goals. And he starts storming off, and he's cussing, yelling at me how I'm a horrible human being, and he's going to kill everyone I know, and my mom's going to die in my sleep, and I'm going to get AIDS. And it's just hilarious to me. In my head, I'm kind of chuckling to myself. But he also really, really liked girls. And so we're walking down the hallway, and he's cussing me out. We turn the corner, and the girl he has a crush on is there. He immediately stops cussing me out and goes, "Hey, how you doing?" Turns around, looks at me, and winks. He goes, "Is that how I'm supposed to do it, John? Move along, move along. Come on, gotta go do goals. You're ridiculous." And he has this moment where his worker tells him that he can't go home to his biological family, which means he's probably going to be in our program for the next 6 months while we figure out his life. He freaks out, and he destroys his room, and he breaks apart his bed and swings a 2x4 at me. And for 4 hours, he yells at the top of his lungs and spins on the floor like he's the game piece from the Game of Life that you spin to see how many spaces you move, and tries to put his fingers in every light socket in the room. And for 4 hours, through a splitting headache, I have to stand there and say nothing because he's in crisis. And if I say anything, it's just going to make it worse. And so you just sit there and you watch this human being that the world has rejected. And you just hope that you realize that, like, we won't reject you. And for 4 hours, he does this. And he stops at 4 hours and he looks at me and he goes, "You're not going to yell at me?" "No, I'm not going to yell at you." "You're not going to tell me to stop?" "No, I don't know what it's like to lose your family, so I'm not going to tell you to stop." He goes, "You passed." "What?" He goes, "Oh, I'm done. I'll clean up the mess. I'll accept my consequences. I was being a jerk. I'm sorry." And I walk out of the room with a splitting headache, really wishing I could drink on the job, going, "What was that?" And so the next couple days, we're talking about it, and we're sitting at a table, and we're talking about his family, and he's getting nervous and fidgety because he doesn't like it, and I understand that. That's not fun to talk about. It's the weirdest thing about social work. You sit someone down and go, "Let's talk about all the bad things that happened to you." If that was one of us, we would get up from the table and not pay the bill and never talk to that person again. But when you do this, that's what you're supposed to do. And so he grabs a little yellow Post-it note, and he starts folding it, and he's just messing with it. And I just think he's using it as a fidget to keep himself entertained. And eventually he stops, and he unfolds his hand, and he folded the little yellow note into an origami crane. And now I don't care about what happened to him in his life. I don't care about his biological family. I want to know how he learned how to do that. I'm like, "Oh my God, that is amazing. That is so cool. I can't do that. How did you learn how to do that?" And he goes, "John, when you're locked in the closet, you got a lot of time on your hands." Funny and sad. Loved this kid. And so we started making origami art all over the place. And he would make big origami art, and I'd sit and help him, and then he would tell me I was horrible with my hands and get out. And he'd make little pieces, and then if I ever had a girlfriend at the time, he would make some origami art and go, "Impress the girl, give it to her." So I told the girl I made it. And we created this bond, and we created an art show, and we invited everyone from campus and his social worker and people that were in his life to check out this origami art show, and it was awesome. And he really started to come out of his shell, and he really started to figure out who he was as a person. But unfortunately, when you are a teenager and your family has done these things to you and made you an outsider, you know, progress is up and down, and he had another bad day. And this bad day resulted in him attacking me with trying to stab me with a pencil. And we got him calmed down, and he looked at me and he goes, "Man, I know, John, screwed up, shouldn't stab people with a pencil." I said, "Good, you figured that out." And he goes, "I know I have to be away from the group for a while." I said, "Yes, you have to prove you're what?" "I have to prove I'm going to be safe." I said, "Yes." He goes, "But you know that if I'm away from the group by myself for a little bit, I'll get bored, I'll mess with people to entertain myself, and then you'll get upset with me, and then I'll argue with you, and then it'll be a battle all day." And I'm thinking, he's got a point. And he goes, "You don't want the battle all day with me, John." "No, I do not." I go, "What are you getting at? Spit out your story, buddy." And he goes, "I need something to entertain myself." I said, "Okay, I'm down. I can follow this line of thinking." He goes, "I need cardboard, I need tape, and I need a pair of scissors." And I give him that funny look of like, "Are you kidding me?" And he goes, "I won't stab anyone with the scissors, I promise." And mostly because I had a soft spot for him, but also because I was leaving to go off campus with the other kids, and if he tried to stab someone, it wasn't my problem. I gave him the cardboard, the scissors, and the tape. And I come back 4 hours later, and I turn the corner, and this kid who had been rejected by society and 10 programs and, you know, 5 or 6 foster homes built a suit of armor in 4 hours out of cardboard, duct tape, and a pair of scissors, complete with sword that was 3 feet long that went into a sheath. And I turned the corner and he goes, John, look what I did. Whoom, whoom, whoom. And I'm so happy. I'm like, that's amazing. Why am I not that creative? So now I'm jealous of a 14-year-old kid. So I go home and I'm like, this kid's got something and I want to show him like how cool he is. And so I decide that I'm going to build my own giant cardboard outfit. And he really liked Transformers. And I really like Transformers because I'm still 13 at my heart. And so I'm not as good as he is. So it took me 4 weeks to figure out how to build a Transformer costume and attach it to my body and everything. I didn't tell him a word. And so I come into work and I'm sitting in car mode. So this actually transforms into a car. It takes like 5 minutes, so I'm not going to do it because I'm not agile like I was anymore when I was 24. All right, someone, can you grab the mic for me? And so he turns the corner, and I'm just sitting there in car mode like that. And he goes, what's that? And I pop out. He goes, oh my God, this is so amazing! And I go, yeah, it is. It's so cool. And he goes, who inspired you to do that? And I said, you inspired me to do this. I inspired you? Yes. You were my inspiration. He goes, that's freaking awesome. I've never inspired anyone. I said, yeah, like you're awesome. I want you to know that. And he goes, all right, cool. Take it off so I can try it on. Thank you.
Storyteller John Paul Derryberry. We'll be back in a moment with more Fringe, true stories from outsiders in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're hearing stories that were told last week at a live storytelling event in Iowa City called Fringe, True Stories from Outsiders. Our next storyteller is Ryan Hall. They is Ryan's preferred pronoun. Ryan is a 2-time college dropout, an occasional drag queen, identifies as non-binary and pansexual, and is currently a student at the University of Iowa.
I want to take us back and tell a story of not just myself, but of all of us. Before we were thought of, before we had a name, our parents, the folks who brought us into this world, had an idea of how we would be, of what we would do, of what kind of gender identity we would have. Before I entered this world, I had a name. I had an assigned biological sex, and I had a gender to reflect that. Many of us navigate our lives performing that same gender that reflects our biological sex. But not all of us continue through life expressing that same identity. I recently did drag for the first time. If you're not familiar with drag, it's most oftenly portrayed as men dressing as women, lip-syncing songs, and looking pretty fabulous. But as drag has evolved, drag has included women dressing as men, women dressing as women, or just anyone getting glammed up and putting on a fantastic show. I had some wonderful friends in my life open up the gates to this opportunity, to finding out within myself that I can take my skills, my passions, and translate that into a little wig and hitting the stage. When I was young, I was balancing between the sporty, athletic, manly performance and the more effeminate dancer. I saw at an early age the community that my sister was carving out for herself and her peers within the dance community, and I was a little bit envious of that. Not that I didn't love the sports I played at the time, but I felt that a little bit of movement in my hips would have been a good time for me. But it wasn't until recently that I was introduced into drag, and my drag mother, the Queen Fantasia Woods, helped dress me, put on a face, prepare myself for the stage. There's a quote from a famous drag performer, RuPaul, that says, "You're born naked, and the rest is drag." And as I wrestle with my identity, with my expression, with my gender, and I see it in others, I come to realize the way that we express ourselves is reflected onto us from others. We perpetuate it by choosing the same things in our wardrobe, by appearing the certain ways that we are expected to appear. And that I'm not completely content with maintaining that. Because in this boxed binary that we have, there's a script that we must read from. But not all of us are literate to this script. Not all of us even have the paper that has the words on them. So as I think about my identity, my performance, I think about that night that I first hit the stage as my new persona. Her name is Anya Marks. Get set, go. And she is a fierce Russian export who said a little bit too many controversial things during her time in Russia. But I remember that moment on stage where I am performing to one of my favorite Britney Spears songs, "I'm a Slave for You." And I remember her VMA performance as she comes in, or she performs with this great yellow python and this wonderful just top green dress. She looks extraordinary. And I am Britney in this moment. I am Britney in most moments, but but it was surrounded by my peers, by my coworkers, by my drag mother, by my drag house, by all of these support systems that I felt like the spotlight wasn't burning me like it does when I walk down the street today wearing lipstick. The anxiety that I feel about funking with the matrix, with the identity binary, it's restricting, to say the least. But it was on stage that I felt free. And I'm trying to achieve this freedom, not for myself, but for all of us. You should be able to live in the box that you choose. The whole thing about embodying a fringe identity is that there needs to be a center to push us to the margins in the first place. Some of us are pushed further away from that center than others. But we are all under some sort of margin or fringe, whether it is our gender, our sexuality, our ethnicity, our socioeconomic status. We are all pushed to a fringe. But in my queer world that I wish to create, construct, and distribute, there is no fringe We all operate from that same center, a plurality of identities, of expressions. We can all be whole without feeling lesser. And so I hope that we can all feel this center, feel like we can be okay with ourselves. Men, if you want to wear lipstick every so often, that's totally fine. You can do that. But my hope for myself is that I can feel liberated to choose which identity I will adopt. And I'll end by quoting the RuPaul again. If you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you gonna love somebody else? Thank you very much.
Storyteller Ryan Hall. Next up is Veronica Hamley. She doesn't consider herself to be an outsider, but she says she does consider herself to be a Goonie. She grew up in Decorah, and people often make assumptions about her. She's living proof that it's important not to judge a book by its cover.
Of all the things that I wanted to be when I grew up, a railroad engineer was at the top of the list. And while that did not exactly happen, I came close. For 10 years, I owned a vintage railroad maintenance car that I would run in the summertime as part of the owner-operator hobbyist group. When I was 31, I was in southern Minnesota on a pretty special railroad trip and was videotaping everything going on that weekend. Unbeknownst to me, the person I had riding with me used my video camera to take some footage of myself. So that night, as I sat in the hotel room, poring through the hours of video that I took, I found the video of myself, and I was shocked by what I saw. I felt like I'd been hit by a train. The girl on the video looked like me, dressed like me, was doing the same things I'd been doing all that day, but there was no way that that was me. She was all crippled and twisted, and that's just not how I saw myself. I had a little bit of a limp and some tight fingers, but that's it. But the girl on the video was me. I have cerebral palsy, which was caused by a lack of oxygen right before I was born. It only affects me physically, but there are some people that have thought that it affected my intellect. When I was 4 months old, my mom had to change pediatricians because the first one wrote on my chart that I was mentally retarded. For the most part, through the years, it's just people making assumptions about my physical ability, whether it be occupationally or socially. People assume I can't do something rather than asking me if I can do something. A few weeks prior to seeing that video of me at the railroad event, I had been fired from my job for not being able to type fast enough. A mentor of mine was also going through cancer, and he would pass away a few weeks later. But rather than get into a slump, I got a few regrettable tattoos. But beyond that, I had unemployment insurance, a summer of railroading, and a desire to go back to the University of Iowa to finish my degree. So I decided to hold my head high and not think about that video, because what I saw on that video was nothing that I could change. So for the last 10, 15, 20 years, I've had these thoughts nagging me in the back of my mind. There's the old saying, it's better to have loved and lost than to never have loved at all. And movies such as The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Never Been Kissed. I did not want my life summed up this way. So I decided that if I wasn't married, didn't have kids, or at least didn't have a relationship by the time I got close to turning 40, I just would not turn 40. But really, all I want is to meet that one woman, to spend my life with. Maybe if I could do that, all of the other challenges and disappointments in my life would fade into the background. Because what scares me the most is being alone when my mom, who's my best friend, is no longer here. So I guess one of the best things that I have going on for me is that everybody thinks that I'm a lot younger than I actually am. I don't know if it's my exceptionally good looks or whether I just have a youthful personality, but earlier this year I turned 39 for the second time. And even though I've still never been kissed, and V symbolizes more than just the first initial of my name, something happened last summer that changed my outlook on life. It was the second week of school, and one of my fourth graders came up to me at recess and asked me if I would get together with her and her family sometime. I was so excited, so amazed, and so confused all at the same time, because nothing like that had ever happened before. And even though they keep pretty busy, I've become friends with a family that has three wonderful children and two parents around my age. And I've created some of the best memories that I've had since junior college. And even though I still haven't gotten what I've wanted most out of life, marriage, children, family, I'm reminded of a Rolling Stones song with the lyric, "You don't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you might just find that you get what you need."
And now, she was was going to meet her connection. At her feet was this tall, footloose man. You can't always get what you wanna. I say you can't always get what you wanna. You can't always get what you wanna. But if you try sometime, you might find you can get what you need.
Storyteller Veronica Hamley. We'll be back with more Fringe, true stories from outsiders in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're listening to stories that were told last week at a live storytelling event in Iowa City called Fringe, True Stories from Outsiders. We're going to hear two more stories today, and our next storyteller is Daniel Tardy. He is an engineer, the founder of a company called House to Home and an organization called Stay and Grow. He's also an acrobat who has traveled the world studying acro yoga. Storyteller Daniel Tardy.
Who am I, you may ask? What am I, you may ask? Instead, you may want to ask the more important question. Who will you become once my story is complete? Imagine a world where human beings sit in an office for 8 to 10 hours a day. 5 days a week, for 50-ish weeks in a year, for 20 to 30 years. How would they be graded in this life? By the time they put in? By the bonuses they receive or don't receive? By their hourly rate or annual income? This is largely how our human capacity and contribution is measured. I too lived in this reality. As an electrical engineer, I was put in charge of an ever-changing and forever growing list of responsibilities for a company who was dependent upon my daily time, energy, effort. One night in 2014, while at work, I was alone in a laboratory at 2 a.m., sitting at a desk, working as I started to lose consciousness. I tried to snap out of it, shook my head, smacked my face a couple of times. Nothing worked. I was fading fast. How had my life come to this? I began to reflect on my life and the one conversation that led directly to this life-changing moment. Imagine me as a little boy spending time at my grandparents' house. It was the equivalent of a Disney World vacation. Imagine having caretakers who were just old enough to not understand the details of your day-to-day activities. To them, I was just playing with my toys. When in reality, I was learning and living dangerously, figuring out how to manipulate electricity from the wall plug to power my handmade toys and cobble creations. I guess you can say I was inquisitive, exploratory, continuously asking the big questions. How do I take my Erector set and my Kinect set and integrate them with my Domino Rally and Hot Wheels cars? By then, I knew I had taken after my grandfather. You see, my grandfather was a rule breaker. In fact, he would agree that the only rules are the ones you abide by. He was a risk taker, a businessman, an entrepreneur, a leader, and one of the funniest men I knew. The day I decided to tell my grandfather that I was thinking of quitting my engineering job to follow my dreams of developing a real estate company was one of the scariest moments of my life. How could I tell him I was abandoning 4 years of rigorous education from Rose-Hulman Institute of Technology? The same school represented on his license plate. The same school that nearly broke me every year. But why was I afraid? He had done the same, right? Followed his own path, the path less traveled, in a time where people like him didn't have half as many freedoms that exist for me today? Why couldn't I? I walked into the dining room where he sat in his favorite chair. His shoes freshly shined, his jeans freshly ironed, with a crease, of course. "Granddaddy," I called out as if I were 4 years old, "I want to talk to you about my real estate stuff," as if to attempt to diminish the importance of it. By that time, I owned over 20 homes, though my family was under the assumption I owned two at the most, and I liked it this way. Can't be rocking the family boat too much. "Okay, grandson, what you got?" I braced myself, as this was the moment right before he was going to call me crazy, to tell me how stupid of an idea it was, and ask me why would I give up such a good job with great benefits and a guaranteed paycheck? And most importantly, how would I retire like he had, so that one day I too could sit at my dining room table with my shiny shoes and creased jeans? I swallowed deep and took a breath. "I'm thinking about quitting my job, you know, to focus on what I enjoy and love. Being a creator, a creative, an innovator, solving social issues through my real estate company." In that moment, I realized I hadn't uttered a word, only thought about what I really wanted to tell him. When the words finally came out, I said, "I want to fix up houses." I figured this was a safe route. Keep it simple, right? He was a carpenter in his younger years, so maybe I'd have him on my side. He slowly lowered his newspaper and got up from the table, stepped into the kitchen to start some coffee. I thought to myself, shit, he's buying himself time to find the words to let me know how ridiculous this all was. In fact, the fear I felt pointed to one thing. I had built the success of my crazy dream on the foundation he had laid years ago. And not a financial one, but a foundation of possibility. And the last thing I would want is for him to take that away. He cleared his throat. "I like that idea, grandson," he exclaimed. "Yeah, yeah. Instead of going back to school, this can be your master's degree." I was shocked. In a million years, I never expected these words to come out of his mouth. But why not? You see, the answer is simple. Since I was little, I had been asked the same question. What did I want to be when I grow up? And I noticed as I got older, this question morphed into, where do you want to go to college? And what do you want to study? But never was I asked who I wanted to be, or even how I wanted to help shape the world. Or the most important question, what I would do with my time if and when I retired at 30 years old. And that's exactly what I was aiming to do. And this is exactly what led me to that moment in the laboratory, sitting at the desk, fighting to stay conscious. As I put countless hours into maintaining my day job, while simultaneously fighting for the life I yearned to live outside of my day job. Despite being exhausted, I'd made it through the night, and by 5 a.m., I started to quickly pack my things and head home for 4 to 5 hours of sleep. Quickly, not only because I was tired, but because I was wearing the same clothes from the day before and wanted to avoid anyone walking in and noticing my fringe look. You see, my 9 to 5 was more like 9 a.m. on Monday to 5 a.m. on Tuesday, then repeat. I was willing to put in the time, energy, effort, both for my company and for my purpose. But it was my grandfather who set that standard for me, that being an innovator, a rule breaker, a risk taker were normal, everyday behaviors. My grandfather had signed a permission slip like none other, one that would allow me to walk away from my career by age 30, to fall deeper into my purpose on this planet. And part of that purpose is to help other people with their permission slips to follow their purpose on this planet. Purpose was not defined by my job, and my job didn't define what or who I was, but it did become the foundation for who and what I was becoming. Who am I, you ask? What am I, you ask? I'm still figuring it out, and hopefully you are as well. Thank you.
That was Daniel Tardy of Cedar Rapids. And our final story comes from Miriam Alarcón Avila. She is an Iowa City-based storyteller who was born in Mexico City. And after working a 33-hour day, she came to the storytelling event at a last-minute notice to tell her story about her ophthalmologist visit earlier that day and how the experience of getting her eyes dilated and seeing blurry images relates to how she thinks about people being marginalized and feeling on the margins of society. Miriam Alarcón Avila.
And when Heather texts me and he say that if I want to come here and tell you a story, she mentioned the theme is French. It's the first time I hear that word. I have no idea what the heck is. The first thing I answer is texting back. I think I can do it. What the heck is that thing? When I try to tell my kids how I can pronounce the word correctly, they just give up because they say it's not correct. It's okay. Between these 33 hours I was working, I stopped when a break. My break was to run to the doctor, to the eye appointment. I have an eye appointment to check my eyes because I've been having troubles with my eyes. I'm a photographer for Hancher. I work with my eyes. I'm a visual artist. So for me, the eyes are very important. When I was there, I'm guessing all of you who use glasses already know that they have to put you these drops so your eyes, your pupillas just poop, and then you become an owl. And I went back to work to the co-op. And at the moment, my eyes still dilate. So when I start to look the lights, I start to see only stars. I come back to the word dilate because when I was, my daughter drive me over here because I couldn't drive correctly. She teach me to pronounce the word. My kids are the ones who teach me how to speak English in a better way. And they always break the words into, she say, die late. Oh, like dying late, like you don't wanna be on time to die. Okay, so I die late my eyes. And with this, I can see stars all around. These stars was the beautiful lights I used to see when I was a little girl. When I was 8 years old, my mother learned that I need glasses. So during the first 8 years of my life, I live in a world full of stars. I couldn't see things. People is only faces with light. The moon was like a blurb of light. When I was wearing for first time my glasses, I learned that things have a limit. It's very precise. Things have un margen. Things have a fringe. Things are always border with something. But when I take my glasses out, I can see stars. So one of the things I used to see when I was a kid is I used to look for people for a long time. They probably thought that I was crazy because I just look at them for a long time, but in reality I could not see them. I just see this blurb. But when I put attention, and it's a beautiful light setting on the person, I can see beautiful light coming through, like a star. So I used to love, lose myself in the light of the persons. And in one moment I thought, in reality we are all light. If we are all light and we can expand our beams of light in a very long directions, all over, everywhere, why we want to put things in a margin? Why we want to put everything in a border? Why we want to put everything surrounded by something? As a Latino, I've been marginalized, I've been discriminated because my pronunciation, because my grammar is really bad, because sometimes I have to express myself in different ways because I don't have the words in English to express myself. That has been putting a French around me. And that French, unfortunately, is around everyone who doesn't look like you. So if we are allied, I choose to die late every day. I choose to see stars. I choose to extend my beams of light, and I invite you to do the same. Take your light from within and spread it out and dilate, dilate, dilate. Thank you.
That was storyteller Miriam Alarcón Avila of Iowa City. This hour, we've been hearing stories from Fringe, true stories from outsiders, an Iowa Watch storytelling event co-sponsored by Iowa Public Radio. The event was hosted by Iowa Public Radio's Lindsay Moon and edited for broadcast by Emily Woodbury. The stories were recorded on March 29th, 2018. We had engineering assistance from Jim Davies. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.